Welcome to the Campbell Conversations. I'm Grant Reher. Most political observers and most citizens lament the hyper-partisanship that seems to be getting in the way, not just of political problem solving, but even the ability to have a productive political conversation. My guest today thinks that partisanship, if it's done right, could actually be the solution rather than the problem. Julian Zelizer is a professor of history and public affairs at Princeton University, and he's also a CNN political analyst. He's written a new book titled In Defense of Partisanship. Professor Zelizer, welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me on your show.
Oh, I really appreciate you making the time. So, let me just start with a very basic question. What are the benefits of partisanship that most citizens might not be fully aware of?
I think if you look at American history, certainly until the 1990s and 2000s, parties did several things. One, they often were important to generating some of our most important leaders and moments when big ideas get onto the table, whether it's Franklin Roosevelt and the New Deal or Ronald Reagan and the 1980s, the first through the Democrats, the second through the Republicans. Second, and this is still important today, they do offer a way to channel division and serious differences in the electorate over issues through the established political process as opposed to outside of it. Three, they serve as a way to connect the very disjointed political system that we have, the different branches of government, the different levels of government within federalism. And finally, when they've worked well, they have served, and they do this in other countries, as checks against some of the most extreme leaders, often populists. And we can talk about why that might not be happening today, but historically, that's been very important to keeping them out of leadership positions. So those are four functions we've seen again and again since the founding that I think we need to remember and digest before people move to simply abandoning the idea of partisanship altogether.
Okay. And is there a distinction in what you're talking about here between having a partisan system and partisanship per se? Go ahead.
No, not necessarily. I mean, I think the fights that constitute partisanship, it's not simply a partisan system. It's two parties as adversaries and two parties really trying to either win over the other in terms of a question, whether it's economic policy or foreign policy, or ultimately two strong parties disagreeing but reaching that agreement. I mean, bipartisan agreements often come when you have two very strong parties rather than weak ones. I think that is partisanship. So it's not simply a partisan system. It is the actual process of partisans fighting that I think has often been healthier than we think.
Interesting. And what would you make then of the concerns or this notion of hyper-partisanship? We often hear that. We're in a period of hyper-partisanship.
Well, I talk about that, and I talk about the last two, three decades. I date it from the 90s. Others date it a little close to our own times. But we've seen a partisanship. For me, that means a partisanship where there are no guardrails, meaning the leaders of the parties accept a system where anything is permissible, and that means any process is fair game in the partisan wars. Any rhetoric is permissible in terms of how you speak as a leader. And really, any policy can be jettisoned or manipulated in these processes. And finally, at the electoral level, I think a hyper-partisanship is a partisanship where there's no space almost for social interaction outside of the political system, or even seeing friends, neighbors, or strangers outside a partisan lens. And I do think when people talk about that today, that's what they're talking about. I do argue that's a problem, but that needs to be separated from very healthy partisanship.
Okay. So it's kind of like a, let's not throw the baby out with the bathwater kind of argument. So I want to connect two things that you've said here, and just right at the beginnings of our conversation. You alluded earlier to one of the functions of parties is to screen out more populist, and I would insert in there, I don't know if you use the word, but say potentially dangerous leaders. And then you just now talked about, in describing hyperpartisanship, the fact that anything goes, that that there are no guardrails. So say a little bit more about those two things, because I think that's an important combination. And perhaps you could also give us some historical examples that you have in mind where the parties have performed that function.
Yeah, I mean, two examples from post-World War II history that I often think about. One was Senator Joe McCarthy, who was a pretty dangerous force in American politics, and embodied a kind of conservative populism, a fierce mm-hmm. anti-communist, but did it in a way where he was smearing everyone, ruining lives, and risking the kind of policy of actually fighting anti-communism for this reactionary process. And he survives for a while, and for about 4 years, 1950 to 54, he's a big influence in American politics. But ultimately, the Republican Party, the leadership, stops him. They push back. They do not allow him to become a leader. He never becomes a leader of the party. He's not the minority leader. He doesn't run for president. And they check him, and they stop him. On the Democratic side, you had George Wallace in the 1960s, who is a big force in the South, a fierce opponent of segregation, of desegregation, mm-hmm. and really the face for many Americans of the forces of reaction to civil rights. And ultimately, he'll run as a third party candidate. He starts trying to run in the primaries, but he is not incorporated and included in the kind of leadership of the Democratic Party. So those are two examples where you see that happening. And the second question, I think of a lot of things since, I mean, I do give a history and I do focus on the Republican Party. I argue that I think historically you've seen greater radicalization of partisanship in the GOP from Newt Gingrich to the Tea Party to Donald Trump. And one issue, very concrete, is this thing called the debt ceiling, where Congress has to vote. It's a measure put into place in the early 20th century. And they have to vote to essentially agree to pay for what they've agreed to pay for. And if they don't do it, we go into default as a country. And while symbolically there had been legislators who opposed this in the past, they only really did it when they knew it was going to pass. No one thought of threatening the health of the country for a budget fight. But we've seen a real shift. In 2011, the Tea Party was quite serious about potentially not raising that to get budget cuts from President Obama. And we are today in 2025 at a moment when this is happening not annually in some way. Mm-hmm. The possibility of not raising that is now just a normal tool. And there's even kind of rumors that Democrats might, who have avoided this, might be thinking about that now with President Trump. So that's a real sea change. And that's a kind of partisanship. It sounds technical, but what you're talking about is the willingness to devastate the entire country to score political points. And that's what I mean by hyperpartisanship.
You're listening to The Campbell Conversations on WRVO Public Media. I'm Grant Reher, and I'm speaking with Princeton professor Julian Zelizer, and we're discussing his new book. It's titled In Defense of Partisanship. I want to come back a little bit later to the absence of the guardrails and that concern again with the current state that we're in. But I want to go a little bit back in time, because you do talk about this in your book, and I think it's important for understanding the vision that you have. There were a lot of political reforms that were made in the aftermath of Watergate in the 1970s, and you write about that. What do we most need to keep in mind about those in that era now, do you think?
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting. If you read the newspapers and books about politics for the general public in the 50s and 60s, the big problem with politics was bipartisanship. And reformers were really frustrated with the bipartisan coalition in Congress of Southern Democrats and Republicans, who they argued behind closed doors, without accountability, constantly frustrated efforts to make progress on civil rights, on health care, on urban reform. And they argued the way the bipartisanship worked inherently was just bad. It was secretive, and it watered down the choices voters actually, they voted for one party, but that's not what they got. In the end, they just got this deal making that left them with nothing substantive. And so there's all these reforms after Vietnam and Watergate in Congress that really try to strengthen the parties. They centralize power in party leaders. They weaken committee chairs. They open up the process to sunshine, television cameras, sunshine laws, so that people can make sure parties are being accountable. And there's all sorts of reforms that I go through that by the end of the 70s and through the 80s, Congress is a much more partisan place. And the parties are much more forceful. They're much more centralized. And there's fewer kind of points where committee leaders are doing whatever they want as they had in the past. And there's problems with it. You know, it becomes harder to negotiate deals. But I think through the 1980s, you kind of get what reformers were hoping for. It's an American-style partisanship. It's not like England. Right. But it's a much a more forceful partisan presence in both parties by the time Reagan's in office.
So then if partisanship isn't the story of the problems that we're in now, that, you know, if we are going to agree that the current American political system has some significant dysfunctions in it, what is the story of how we got here?
Yeah, well, I talk about the two things happening since the 90s. One is you had a sea change in the Republican Party, and I talk about it starts with Newt Gingrich, who is in Congress in the 1980s and will become Speaker of the House in 94. And he's a really big proponent of a what I call a smash mouth approach to partisanship. He's sick of bipartisan ideas. He doesn't really care about civility. And he tells Republicans, you need to be much more ruthless in pursuit of power. This needs to be the priority, not governing, not worrying about the health of the institution. It has to be all out. And he wins and he becomes a leader. And I think he inspires a whole new generation of Republicans to shed older concerns about the limits of what you can do. And that process is amplified in the 2010s with the Tea Party. And it culminates with the MAGA Republicans on Capitol Hill, where it is a no guards rail partisanship that the entire party has embraced. And I think Democrats, some Democrats do this, but as a whole, the Democrats have not moved that far. In part, it's not moral. They're a party of government. And so they just can never afford to ultimately create that kind of dysfunction. It contradicts what they're about. And the second thing that has worked in concert with this is we've had this period since the 90s where neither party can build a stable coalition. So every election, there's the potential that a party loses power. In contrast to the period from the really 30s through the 90s, with a few exceptions, where Democrats had a coalition that was unbreakable. And so because of that, you have these incentives on Capitol Hill. A political scientist, Francis Lee, wrote about this, where all the incentives are to be as fierce against your opponent as possible, because you might end up giving them power. There's no room for flexibility in that system.
Yeah, I think that's a super important point. And just to underline it, if we think about that time period, you just have a series of very close presidential elections. And then you also have this shifting back and forth of the control of the chambers of Congress, so that exactly what you're saying, each party is either on the brink of winning something big or losing something big, and they're not too interested in bargaining under those circumstances. You're listening to the Campbell Conversations on WRVO Public Media. I'm Grant Reher, and I'm talking with Professor Julian Zelizer, the Princeton University History and Public Affairs professor, has written a new book. It's titled In Defense of Partisanship, and we've been discussing his book and the larger issues that it raises. So I'm going to jump right in on this one and just ask you my really big question here, because you really teed it up before the break quite nicely. Is then this an instance of the, going back to the founders, really, is this a problem of civic virtue? The people who occupy these offices and these leadership positions, you mentioned Newt Gingrich and him changing sort of the ways that Republicans think about what they're doing. Or is this a situation where we need to change the institutions and the structures in order to create different incentives? In other words, you know, the James Madison kind of approach here. How do you come down on ultimately your diagnosis of the problem and then what you would do to make it better?
I think you need both. I mean, I think if you have more virtuous leaders with problematic procedures, it will be hard to maintain that virtue, and there'll be a lot of pressure to deploy the weapons that are available. And if you just have better procedures and leaders who don't take the responsibilities of governing more seriously, they will find a way to take those procedures and to do bad things with them. So in the book, I really try to point to reforms that tackle both of those at the same time, and address just the overall quality of the parties as well. But I think it has to be a two-track approach. And if we just do this piecemeal over time and don't deal with both elements of where we are today, we will find ourselves with the same problems come 10, 20 years.
Well, and so then what are the most important things that you want to put out there on the table for changes?
Well, my final chapter after this whole history is how to try to fix this, focusing on Capitol Hill. One, I do argue we need reforms that take away what I call the weapons of mass destruction that the parties have used. So back to the debt limit, I do believe proposals to either eliminate it, it's not part of the Constitution, or reform it. So there's an automatic process that is not subject to the congressional whims. That would be very healthy, because there's different kinds of ways parties fight. That one's just way too dangerous, and we can't keep putting ourselves through that. Take it away, and don't allow that to be a part of the contingency of politics. Second, I do argue that what is called regular order is useful, meaning having a legislative process like we learn in school, but has been jettisoned, will actually help restrain the parties and make them accountable to their own members. I believe if the rank and file have a way to know they're part of the debates, they're part of the negotiation, you'll have more buy-in for whatever the outcome is and create just a more stable culture on Capitol Hill. Third, I argue that we need reforms, and I go through a bunch of them that people have been talking about, that will create better connections between members of the House and senators and their constituents, whether it's using new kinds of technology to facilitate better town hall interaction and more regular conversations, to expanding the size of the House, which is a bigger reform. But the key is you need reforms where you don't just have very angry voters and very angry leaders, but a connection between them. So they're in dialogue with each other and the party works as a whole, rather than just a top-down thing. And finally, in the most ambiguous or amorphous, but back to what we said, quite important, we need new leaders who take norms of governing as seriously as anything else. And in studies of leadership, we often talk about transformative leaders, leaders who put forward big ideas in American politics that change the way we think. So Reagan is an example for many conservatives. We talk about transactional leaders. Those are leaders who are great at coalition building and making deals. Bill Clinton is someone who's often pointed to in modern times. But I say we need a generation of normative leaders, leaders who actually prioritize establishing stable norms of governing and making consideration of what's healthy for us as a democratic society as important as the power grab, as important as the power fight. That doesn't mean not being a hard partisan. It doesn't mean not fighting tooth and nail for the ideas your party believes in, but also spending a lot of time, as we saw a little of this from Joe Biden as president. We saw some of this from Liz Cheney in her final year and then post-congressional period. That's what we need, and we need a young generation that takes that seriously. So I go through all four areas, and I think we have to address it in that sweeping a fashion if we're serious about trying to fix where we are.
If you've just joined us, you're listening to The Campbell Conversations on WRVO Public Media. I'm Grant Reher, and my guest is Princeton University professor Julian Zelizer. I want to pick up on that very last point. I was thinking of Joe Biden when you were talking, and it was my impression, and still my impression now, that he and some of the other Democratic leaders engaged in that rhetoric, but there was also a sense I discerned that rhetoric was being weaponized in a way that kind of fit the hyper-partisanship problems that you and I were discussing. I don't know if that is important, a distinction to make there in that case, or if you picked up on that in your observations when you were listening to the leaders.
Well, there is some of that. And I mean, what I worry about is I still think the Democrats are in a different place. In Congress, a model I think of as responsible partisanship in our day is former Speaker Nancy Pelosi, okay, who was very partisan. And
yes,
she kept her party in line. If you broke with her in the Democratic Party, there was a price to pay. If you supported the party, you would be rewarded. She was very tough with her adversary. She used the legitimate tools available in Congress to try to stop Republicans and stop the Trump administration. That's responsible partisanship. And I don't think, especially in a day we're divided, there's anything wrong with that. I do see signs a little bit toward the end of the Biden presidency, for sure, in terms of both some of the rhetoric, but even at the presidential level with the pardons. And now we're hearing, just keeping in this part of the conversation, ruminations the Democrats might use the debt ceiling, which they really have not done, to try to stop Trump. I think the threat is basically if you have two different sides and one side has jettisoned rules, the other party, the Democrats, are at a crossroads. They either keep fighting through legitimate means, which can be frustrating, or they also jettison the rules, which might be satisfying on the short term and may be effective. But then we are in an incredibly dangerous place and we lose one of the checks we still have. So I don't know where we're going. I see what you're talking about. And I think the next few years will actually be quite important in terms of not just can Democrats respond to the Trump administration, but how do they respond and can they maintain those guardrails as they put up a hard fight?
So you have alluded to the Trump administration a couple times. I've alluded to it as well. So let me just ask you some very direct questions about it. Let's think about the here and now. And I should say for our listeners, you and I are talking on Friday morning, February 7th. Things should have been changing rather quickly in this new administration. In fact, I can't remember a first couple weeks of a presidency like this. President Trump has obviously come out of the gate swinging, to say the least. What's your impression of the moves that the administration has made in these early days?
Very aggressive. And I do think fundamentally destabilizing. And you've seen a combination of two things. I think the president has used executive power in a very bold fashion, really trying to circumvent established law on things like impounding funds that Congress has appropriated and going after federal employment where it's not clear he has the authority to do what he's doing, but is doing it anyway. Combined on the Republican side, which I expected, strong Republican support. This is not being done without the party. And I think it's a mistake to think of him as just doing this on his own. He is doing it with the firewall of congressional Republicans who are not saying a thing. and allowing him to move forward because it's in their interest, in their mind at least, for the party. And you saw this with the confirmations, meaning there was all this hubbub of, will some Republicans break, and will Senator Bill Cassidy as a physician oppose RFK's nomination? None of that has happened. And so you have strong presidential power with a Republican Party allowing this to happen, and that's a pretty combustible combination. And I think the question is, do congressional Democrats as a minority have the strength and savvy to slow this down, combined with the courts? And a lot of this is ending up in the courts, and we will see. Now federal judges are slowing things down, but we will see if some of this is overturned. But it's, and I'd add one other thing as we record. I mean, there's this other part of the story which I think is significant, and that is Elon Musk, where you have a very, very powerful, wealthy figure who is not a confirmed person in the administration, who is working with a whole team that people literally don't know who he is, really making pretty big moves, including being part of this effort to shut down USAID, and also having immense conflict of interest. He has lots of government contracts. And so there's serious questions about someone making these decisions and having this influence, and at the same time having a vested interest in what government does. So I don't think it's hysterical to worry. And I think the implications for the democracy, not just for policy, are going to be quite significant in terms of how this plays out.
Is it fair to conclude from everything you've just said that there is a war on our political system that's being waged right now?
I hate to say it, but I think that's a fair assessment. And I don't think this is about being conservative or liberal, Democrat or Republican. This is about where you stand on our democratic institutions. And you are going back, and I would argue you are in an era a little bit like the Nixon years, where a president is seriously testing our constitutional boundaries.
Yeah, and after 1972, his re-election, he went on a purge of high-level government employees, as I recall. That was Professor Julian Zelizer. And once again, his new book on an extremely important topic is titled In Defense of Partisanship. Professor Zelizer, thanks so much for taking the time to talk with me. I learned a lot today.
Thanks for having me on the show.
You've been listening to the Campbell Conversations on WRBO Public Media, Conversations in the Public Interest.
The Campbell Conversations, Conversations in the Public Interest, is hosted and produced by Grant Reher. The program is edited by Mark Levonier. The Campbell Conversations is a joint production of the Campbell Public Affairs Institute at Syracuse University's Maxwell School of Citizenship and WRVO Public Media. To learn more about the program and hear previous interviews, visit wrvo.org/Campbell Conversations.